a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
The order, we assume that on the way, and we're going to begin because we have people here to testify. We will dispense with approving the minutes until they arrive. So, but in the meantime, we can go ahead and get our reports on schedule. And I'm going to ask everybody to just bow their head a minute, and we'll all say a short prayer. God, we ask you today to set with this committee and give us a guidance in a direction to affect not only our state and tribal relations committee, but our people throughout the state of South Dakota, that we can do some good in for our people, and that something we use our guidance to do things that we can do and not fret of those things that we cannot do. So with that, I ask you to bless us all in Jesus' name. Amen. Ask Charlie McGingan from the Office of the Attorney General to...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the State Tribal Relations Committee. I'm Charlie McGuigan, the Chief Deputy Attorney General, and Tom asked me about a month ago if I would be willing to give the committee a little bit of background on jurisdictional issues in South Dakota affecting the state and Indian country. And he also asked me to give you a little bit of background as to how we got to where we are. And so, first of all, this here is a map showing where Indian country is in South Dakota. We have 9 recognized tribes in South Dakota. And this is a map that we use in our office quite a bit. It's an old map. And for whatever reason, when I did the PowerPoint, it reversed, and I could not get it to unreverse. So I also brought the foam core version, which is a little bit easier to see since it's on a white background instead of black. These are our 9 recognized tribes. The areas in green are what we call closed reservations, or reservations that have not been in any way diminished through acts of Congress or by judicial action. So, for example, Standing Rock and Cheyenne River, those portions of the Pine Ridge Reservation that are in southern Jackson and Shannon County, and the Rosebud Reservation in Todd County, are all areas that have not been diminished in any way by acts of Congress or through judicial action. The areas on this map that are in purple, which would be Bennett County, Millette, Tripp, Gregory, those areas through acts of Congress were open to non-Indian settlement. And that has resulted in what we call diminished areas. The Sisseton Wahpeton Reservation up in the northeast part of the state, that was actually disestablished by an act of Congress. However, there is still quite a bit of Indian country up there. And then the Yankton Indian Reservation, on this map it says formerly, just within the past month, the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled that there still is some kind of reservation down there, and we're still trying to determine exactly what the boundaries of that reservation are. But there's approximately, out of an original 400,000 acres, there's about 40,000 acres of reservation area in that portion of Charles Mix County. Go back. Of course, Flandreau, that's a very small reservation. And then we've got the Crow Creek and the Lower Brule. And those are the only two reservations in South Dakota that were never opened up for homesteading. And those are also closed reservations. What is Indian country? Federal law tells us what Indian country is, and there are three categories of Indian country. Everything within a reservation, and so those areas on the map that are green, those are reservations, those are closed reservations. So everything within that area is Indian country. That would be Corson, Dewey, Zeebach, Shannon, Southern Jackson, Millette. Thank you, Senator Bradford. And then Crow Creek and Lower Brule. Those are closed reservations, so everything within those areas are Indian country. Even lands owned by non-Indians are still under federal law Indian country. And as my presentation goes along, you're going to see that land ownership becomes very important in determining who has jurisdiction. The second category of Indian country is dependent Indian communities. In South Dakota, we have two judicially declared dependent Indian communities. One is in Sisseton and one is south of White River. However, there are other dependent Indian communities. Judge Pearsall has recognized that there are some unidentified dependent Indian communities in the Yankton Reservation area. So there are other dependent Indian communities. Those are a little bit harder to identify. And then the final category of Indian country are Indian allotments. Indian allotments are those parcels of land that tribal members selected often over 100 years ago, and they have remained either within their family, being held in trust by the United States for well over 100 years now. So those are the three categories of Indian country, and like I said, they are established by federal law. The South Dakota was affected by a number of treaties and congressional acts. There were treaties prior to 1851, but the treaty that is most often mentioned when you're discussing South Dakota is the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty. That treaty was entered into at Fort Laramie in Wyoming. Between not only the Sioux tribes, but the Crow, the Arikara, the Cheyenne, and I believe there were some other tribes that were involved in that treaty. And it did not establish reservations, but what it did is it set aside or recognized certain areas that the tribes had hunting rights to. It was designed to try and relieve some of the intertribal conflict that was going on. And it was also designed to give some rites of passage to non-Indians. At this time, both the Oregon Trail and the Mormon Trail, there were a number of non-Indians who were heading west to Utah and to Oregon. Their wagon trains were crossing Indian country. There were conflicts. And so one of the purposes of the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty were to try and give safe passage to those settlers who were headed to Utah and Oregon. In 1858, the Yankton Sioux gave up large portions of their territory in southeast South Dakota and Iowa, and the 1858 Yankton Treaty established the current Yankton Reservation in Charles Mix County. In 1867, Sisseton entered into their treaty, which created the Fort Traverse Reservation the Lake Traverse Reservation up in the northeast part of the state. And then the one that gets talked about the most is the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty. That treaty created the Great Sioux Reservation, and it was a result of either what's known as Red Cloud's War or the Powder River War, which was fought in Wyoming and Montana. You can find a number of references that will tell you that is the only Indian conflict that the United States ultimately lost in the end, and the tribes prevailed in that conflict. That resulted in the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty. That treaty did establish reservations. It required the United States to remove the forts that were located along the Bozeman Trail in Wyoming. And it established the Great Sioux Reservation, which was basically all of South Dakota west of the Missouri River, was established as a reservation for the Sioux Indians. The other thing the 1868 treaty did is it recognized those areas of the 1851 treaty that were identified for the Sioux in the 1851 treaty. It still recognized that they could go into those areas and hunt. Probably the most infamous agreement, and it was not a treaty, in 1871 Congress stopped treaties. In 1871, they passed a law that said we will not enter into any more treaties with Indian tribes. So after 1871, everything was done by congressional act. The 1877 Many-Penny Agreement is the agreement that removed the Black Hills from the Great Sioux Reservation. That's the agreement that in 1980, the United States Supreme Court ruled was an illegal taking. In that opinion, the court said that Congress had violated the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty, that they had illegally confiscated those lands in western South Dakota that were removed by the 1877 Many-Penny Agreement, and said that the tribes were not entitled to the land back. However, they were entitled to just compensation for the value of that property in 1877. And I believe I just saw a news article here not very long ago saying that that fund is now over $1 billion. That money is still in the bank, by the way, because the tribes have not taken it. 1887, what's known as the Dawes Act or the Allotment Act, indicated a big shift in the national Indian policy. That act began what's known as the assimilation period. The theory the United States wanted to basically assimilate the Native Americans into the dominant white culture by making them farmers. And so what the Dawes Act did is it basically said every tribal member would get an allotment. We talked about allotments a few minutes ago. So every tribal member would get an allotment. That allotment would be theirs. After a 25-year trust period, they would then get the title to that allotment in fee. They would own it in fee just like any other person. And when that allotment became fee land, they also became subject to state jurisdiction. As a result of the Dawes Act, a lot of the land, not only in the purple areas on the map, but also the green areas, moved from Indian ownership to non-Indian ownership. And then in March of 1889, Congress passed another act that divided what remained of the Great Sioux Reservation west of the Missouri River into our current six reservations in western South Dakota. As part of the assimilation process or the allotment process, various agreements were entered into with the tribes in South Dakota to basically, after the allotments were identified and the tribal members had received their allotments, Congress would send in negotiators to work out agreements with the tribes. And basically, the lands that were surplus, the lands that were not needed for allotments for the tribal members, were then opened to non-Indian homesteading. And again, the idea was to bring non-Indian farmers into these areas and to try and assimilate the Native American populations into the dominant white culture. And so these are various agreements that were entered into with the tribes in South Dakota, opening their reservations up for non-Indian homesteading. And so in 1867, the Sisseton Wahpeton Sioux Tribe entered into their agreement. The United States Supreme Court ruled that that agreement not just opened it up for homesteading, but actually disestablished their reservation. And that's why you will hear people refer to the former Lake Traverse Reservation or the disestablished Lake Traverse Reservation. In 1894, Yankton entered into a similar agreement where all of their surplus property was open to non-Indian homesteading. The Rosebud Sioux Tribe actually entered into three agreements, and that would be the purple areas on the map. In 1904, they agreed to open Gregory County up to homesteading. In 1907, Tripp and Lyman counties to homesteading. And in 1910, Millette County to non-Indian homesteading. And the United States Supreme Court has ruled that those three agreements diminished their reservation so that their current reservation is only Todd County. However, there is still a lot of Indian country in the form of allotments and trust lands in Gregory County, Tripp, Lyman, and Millette. In 1908, Cheyenne River and Standing Rock entered into an agreement that opened up the western halves of their reservations to non-Indian homesteading. The unique thing about those agreements is the United States Supreme Court ruled that those agreements were different enough that it did not detach those areas from the reservation. So even though Western Corson and basically Zeebot County were opened up to non-Indian homesteading, the agreements that those tribes entered into were different enough that those areas opened up remained part of the reservation. And then finally, in 1910, the Ogallala Sioux Tribe entered into an agreement that removed Bennett County from the reservation and opened it up to non-Indian homesteading. And again, there is a lot of allotments and Indian country that still exists in Bennett County. All of these areas are what we call checkerboarded areas, because if you look at a map, there's little squares all over it. It looks like a checkerboard. In 1934, Congress ended the assimilation period with the passage of the Indian Reorganization Act, and it's the Indian Reorganization Act that we are under right now. It ended the allotment process. It returned surplus lands to the tribes. So any of the lands that had been open for non-Indian homesteading and which no one had claimed yet, those lands are returned to the tribes, and those are the original trust lands or tribal trust lands. It created the current process for taking land into trust, and it allowed for the organization of tribal governments. I just have a few maps to demonstrate what I've been talking about. On this map, the area in yellow is the area recognized by the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty as being an area that the Sioux could use, hunt in, travel through. There was some overlap, so there was some overlap with the area set aside for the Crow and the Cheyenne, for example, overlap some of the parts in Wyoming and Montana. But the area in yellow was the part recognized for the Sioux under the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty. The area in orange is the area that remained. All of South Dakota west of the river was a Great Sioux Reservation after the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty. The area in orange is the portion that remained after the 1877 Menipeni Agreement that removed the Black Hills from the Great Sioux Reservation. And then the areas in orange are the areas that were eventually opened up to non-Indian homesteading as part of the Great Sioux Reservation. The areas that are in that maroonish burgundy color are the areas that were never opened up for non-Indian homesteading. And again, this is another map that just shows some of these areas. That area in the pink way over on the western side, that's the area that was removed by the Menipeni Agreement that the Supreme Court found was an unconstitutional taking. And then the area in the brownish. That's the area that in March of 1889 was open to non-Indian homesteading when Congress divided what was left of the Great Sioux Reservation into our current reservation system. Again, here's just another map that kind of demonstrates what I've been talking about. This one shows some of the areas where there are allotments. So those red dots, like in Bennett County, Millette County, Tripp, Gregory, those are allotments that were taken by tribal members prior to the surplus lands being opened for non-Indian homesteading. You'll also see a few other red dots scattered around western South Dakota. There's some south of Pier. There's some west of Oklahoma Chamberlain. Those dots were allotments that tribal members made after the passage of the 1887 Allotment Act and prior to the Act of March of 1889 that divided the what was left of the Great Sioux Reservation into the existing reservation system. So there are some original allotments that exist in western South Dakota that are outside of the six reservation boundaries. The one other interesting thing I would note is that portion of Standing Rock in North Dakota that's, I think that's the Cannonball River, I'm not positive. Is that right, Senator Maher? That portion of the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota that's south of the Cannonball River was part of the Many-Penny Agreement. There's a little light blue or a light purple line that goes around western South Dakota. That was the boundaries of the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty. And when Congress removed the western part of South Dakota from that under the Many-Penny Agreement to compensate for the land that was removed, which is about 7 million acres, they gave the Sioux Nation that little part of Standing Rock that is up in North Dakota, which is about 700 or 800,000 acres, and that was Congress's idea of compensation under the Many-Penny Agreement back in 1877. Jurisdiction. There are primarily two types of jurisdiction that we deal with. The first is criminal jurisdiction. Some of the issues that come up there are investigation of crimes, apprehension of offenders, who gets to prosecute. And most of the court cases in this area comes out of who gets to prosecute. And then also detention. And detention, I don't mean incarceration. Detention kind of falls in with apprehension, and we'll get to that in a little bit. In the civil area, when we get into jurisdictional disputes, it usually is over taxation or regulation, and regulation being like hunting and fishing, business relations, those type of things, and then family relations. First, criminal jurisdiction. There are basically six categories of crimes committed in Indian country, and those are crimes committed by an Indian against an Indian, crimes committed by an Indian against a non-Indian, crimes committed by a non-Indian against an Indian, crimes committed by a non-Indian against a non-Indian, and then victimless crimes by both Indians and non-Indians. That would be DUIs, drug possession, drug distribution, overweight vehicles. Those are victimless crimes where there's not another person who is injured. As far as criminal jurisdiction, this is all established by federal law and by decisions of the United States Supreme Court. So the first category is crimes committed by an Indian against an Indian. And all of this is in Indian country, by the way. So we're talking about within the closed reservations or on an allotment or a piece of trust property, something that qualifies as Indian country under federal law. If the crime is committed by an Indian against an Indian, the state court has no jurisdiction. Federal courts may have jurisdiction if the crime falls under what's known as the Major Crimes Act. The Major Crimes Act actually has some interesting history that is once again connected to South Dakota. Back in the 1880s, a Lower Brule tribal member known as Crow Dog murdered another Lower Brule tribal member known as Spotted Tail, and the tribe went through its traditional process. Crow Dog met with the tribal council or the tribal elders. They imposed basically a restitution agreement that was that made the Spotted Tail's family happy. Everything was handled internally by the tribe, and there was huge outrage by the non-Indian citizens in Dakota Territory that this person was going to get away with murder. So the federal authorities went, they arrested him, he had a trial in Deadwood, he was found guilty of murder and was sentenced to hang. The United States Supreme Court took his case, and in the case called in the matter of Crow Dog, ruled that as federal law existed at that time, the federal courts also did not have jurisdiction over crimes committed by Indians against Indians in Indian country. Again, there was outrage not only in Dakota Territory, but across the country, and Congress acted, and they acted by passing what's called the Major Crimes Act. The Major Crimes Act says that for a list of certain high-class felonies, the federal court system has jurisdiction. Now, the tribal court system also have jurisdiction. So if it's a felony, if it's not one of the crimes that falls under the Major Crimes Act, then it's up to the tribal courts to handle those matters. So a lot of what we would consider misdemeanor offenses are handled by the tribal court system and not by the federal court system and not by the state court system. Those are handled at the tribal court system. Under federal law, a tribal court can only sentence someone to 1 year incarceration. So the maximum penalty a tribal court can impose is a year in jail.
Now, in the tribal court system, are there judges or are there members of the tribe, or who makes the decision on action in tribal court situations? And is it, you know, are they on there for, if it's a committee or if is it a member of the tribe, are they on there for a year or 2 years, or is it depending upon the crime? Could you?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Representative Wink, each tribal court system is a little bit different because each tribe can set up their own system. In South Dakota, ours are all pretty uniform, and they follow the traditional, what we would think of as a traditional court system, with judges who are usually appointed by the tribal council. Most of our tribes have courts of appeals or supreme courts. So the tribal court system in South Dakota is very similar to the South Dakota court system. Again, there are slight variances at each tribe as to who appoints, who can remove, how long they serve. So there are some differences, but basically the tribal court system in South Dakota is very much like the state court system. In other places, that is not true. There are tribal court systems that are based much more along the traditional lines of whatever that tribe followed. So that's not true across the country, but in South Dakota, the tribal court systems are very much like our state court systems.
Charlie, in all the references you were talking about here on the jurisdiction, you're talking about actually on the reservation, because
right, in Indian
the state has full jurisdiction over every Indian in Rapid City. If he commits any kind of crime, he is immediately taken care of and incarcerated. The other thing is that in our case, the court system actually makes a decision whether that crime goes to federal court or whether it stays in tribal court. And this is where a lot of fallacies are happening, because the power of the court system is not separated. So the final, really, court system is the consul. So if I, in my family, if they had an act of violence against, then they come and arrest, they write it up, then they'll make a decision whether that's should go to federal court or whether it should stay. And that's where a lot of our problems come in the criminal court system area. But I know there have been a lot of work to try to get those two systems separated, but most places it's not been done. And I just wanted to say that the reference about state has no jurisdiction, but that's strictly on the reservation part.
You're correct, Senator Bradford. All of these slides deal with Indian country. So outside of Indian country, the state has jurisdiction both criminally and civilly. The second category is crimes committed by an Indian against a non-Indian. And again, state courts don't have any jurisdiction. Federal courts, again, would only have jurisdiction if it fell under the Major Crimes Act, or also what's known as the General Crimes Act, which basically says if you commit a crime on a reservation, including an Indian reservation, that the federal government can prosecute you for that. And so the courts have limited that, though, to only crimes committed by Indians against non-Indians. So again, if the crime is committed by an Indian against another Indian and it doesn't fall under the Major Crime Act, it's not a felony, then that has to be handled by tribal court. And tribal courts could also, and frequently do, prosecute the Indian offender for the crime committed against a non-Indian.
Representative Wink.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you define what percent of Indian blood is considered an Indian in these situations? I know it's been diluted down over the generations and so on. What is, by definition, what is considered an Indian in these situations?
Senator? Representative Wink, again, that's kind of up to each tribe to determine what the requirements are for tribal membership. Under federal law, you have to be an enrolled member in order to qualify as an Indian, with a couple of exceptions that would get really complicated to get into. So basically, if you're an enrolled member of a tribe, you're an Indian under federal law for these jurisdictional purposes. The next category are crimes committed by a non-Indian against a non-Indian. Those are pretty much going to have to be prosecuted by the federal courts. The tribal court does not have any kind of criminal jurisdiction against a non-Indian. Even when the victim of their crime is an Indian, the tribal court does not have any criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians. And, of course, the state court does not have any jurisdiction over a non-Indian who commits a crime against an Indian. The only entity that has jurisdiction of a crime committed by a non-Indian against an Indian is the federal court system. Crimes committed by a non-Indian against a non-Indian, that's state court jurisdiction only. Victimless crimes committed by Indians, state does not have any jurisdiction over that. So if a tribal member is driving while intoxicated within the reservation, that's going to only be handled by the tribal court system. The state court doesn't have any jurisdiction, and the federal courts don't have any jurisdiction. And then victimless crimes committed by non-Indians. So if it's a non-Indian who is driving while intoxicated within Indian country, that's prosecuted by the state. or if they're dealing drugs in Indian country, that's prosecuted by the state if they're a non-Indian. Some of the areas that we deal with, detention of suspects, often when the tribal officer or the highway patrolman sees a car and they suspect they're a drunk driver, they don't know who's in that car until they stop them. And so it often becomes an issue as to who can make the arrest. And so what the federal case law and our case law from our South Dakota Supreme Court says is the highway patrolman, for example, can detain the tribal member until the tribal police arrive. They cannot arrest them. They cannot haul them to jail, but they can detain them for the tribal authorities to show up. And the opposite is true for the tribal police. If the tribal police make a stop or apprehend someone and they end up being a non-Indian, they can detain them until the state authorities arrive. So even though they can't arrest them and they can't prosecute them, they can detain them until the proper authorities get there. Hot pursuit, this happens frequently, actually, where someone commits a crime outside of Indian country and then they go into Indian country and they are not stopped until they're in Indian country. What our South Dakota Supreme Court has said about this is any evidence or crimes committed outside of Indian country can be prosecuted by the state authorities, but any evidence that's gathered or any crimes that are committed once they've crossed into Indian country cannot be prosecuted in the state court system. Frequently, that involves DUIs is the most common area where we see that. So let's say someone is speeding outside of Indian country. The highway patrolman doesn't get them stopped until they're in Indian country. Once they stop them, they determine that they're intoxicated. Well, they haven't made the determination about the DUI until they're in Indian country. So we can issue the citation for the speeding outside of Indian country, but the highway patrolman cannot arrest them for the DUI. They can hold them until the tribal police get there, but they can't make a state arrest for the DUI. Extradition. We have extradition agreements with some of the tribes. Those extradition agreements come and go with the changes in tribal administration. But we do try to extradite and use the tribal court system in order to extradite persons who commit crimes outside of Indian country, and then we can locate them on the reservation. We will try to work with tribal authorities to have them apprehended and then extradited through the tribal extradition process if one exists. And then crimes occurring across boundaries. This just does not happen very often, but you do have instances where someone is standing in Indian country and yet they commit a crime outside of Indian country. One of the examples that happened in South Dakota was when a tribal member was standing in Indian country and they shot at a person outside of Indian country. And our state Supreme Court said that crime was committed in South Dakota and we could prosecute them. Civil jurisdiction. Civil jurisdiction, as far as jurisdiction of the tribe goes, is subject to a case known as the Montana case. You will hear the Montana case frequently referred to. Under Montana, the general rule handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court is that Indian tribes lack civil authority over the conduct of non-members, and in the civil area, membership becomes important in the civil area. In the criminal area, the only importance is whether you're an enrolled member or you're not an enrolled member. But in the civil area, membership of the tribe becomes important. So even if you, for example, if you're an enrolled member at Standing Rock, but you are down on Cheyenne River, the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe may not have civil jurisdiction over you in some circumstances. So membership becomes important in the civil area. Anyway, the Montana general rule is that Indian tribes lack civil authority over the conduct of non-members on non-Indian land. And this is where we begin to see the U.S. Supreme Court tying civil jurisdiction of the tribe to the ownership of property, even within Indian country. And so like I told you, everything on the green areas in those maps, whether it's owned by an Indian or a non-Indian, that's under federal law, that's Indian country. But the United States Supreme Court, starting with the Montana opinion, started to tie, even in Indian country, the tribe's jurisdiction to who actually owns the property. And they found that that's because the tribe's civil authority comes from the right to exclude individuals. So if the tribe can exclude someone from the property, they have civil authority over that person. Because the tribe can't exclude someone from property owned in fee by a non-Indian, they lose some of their civil authority. The U.S. Supreme Court also created two exceptions to this general rule, and you will hear them referred to as the Montana exceptions. The first Montana exception is basically if the non-Indian enters into a consensual relationship with the tribe. So, for example, if you're contracting to do business with the tribe, you need to expect that you're going to be subject to, if there's a dispute over that contract, you're going to be in tribal court, not state court. So if you enter into a consensual relationship with the tribe or a tribal member, that falls under the first Montana exception, and the tribal court system may have civil jurisdiction over you. The second Montana exception, and the one that has resulted in the most litigation, is a tribe may also retain inherent power to exercise civil authority over the conduct of non-Indians on fee lands when that conduct threatens or has some direct effect on the political integrity, the economic security, or the health or welfare of the tribe. So if a non-Indian on non-Indian fee land is engaging in some kind of conduct, and the tribe can show that it is threatening the political integrity or the economic security or health or welfare of the tribe may have civil jurisdiction. Now, I will tell you, the second Montana exception has been even further eroded by recent U.S. Supreme Court cases. The most recent one was Plains Commerce Bank, which was a dispute that arose on the Cheyenne River Reservation. The U.S. Supreme Court handed down their ruling in 2008, and I'm not going to read that whole thing, but this next slide is the big one, and they basically have limited the second Montana exception to situations that are necessary to avert catastrophic consequences. So most persons who study this area look at the Plains Commerce Bank decision as severely limiting the tribal authority under the second Montana exception. Okay, that was the tribe's civil jurisdiction. Now we're going to talk a little bit about the state's civil jurisdiction. The United States Supreme Court has recognized that two barriers exist to state civil jurisdiction. The first is that it may be preempted by federal law or federal policy. And the second is state civil jurisdiction may infringe on the right of reservation Indians to make their own laws and be ruled by them. This is known as the Bracker test, which is the other case that you will hear talked about a lot when you're talking about civil jurisdiction, is the Bracker opinion. The two barriers are independent. That means that you only need to show there's federal preemption, or you need to show that it would unfairly infringe on the tribe's rights. And then this is what's known as the Bracker test. When on reservation conduct involving only Indians at issue, state law is generally inapplicable. So it will be a very rare situation when the state of South Dakota will have state civil jurisdiction over a non-member's conduct within or within a, with a member, tribal member's conduct within their reservation. And that's because the state's regulatory interest is likely to be minimal and the federal interest encouraging tribal government is at its strongest. And here is the actual Bracker test. It requires a particularized inquiry into the nature of the state, federal, and tribal interests at stake, designed to determine whether this, in the specific context the exercise of state authority would violate federal law. And basically what that means, after you take all the legal jargon and lawyer talk out of it, is that when we're talking about civil jurisdiction in Indian country, and again, this involves when the state's trying to regulate non-Indian conduct in Indian country, the federal courts require us to enter into this balancing test, and they basically look at the services received by the tribe, the services received by the state, what impact there will be on the different governments to determine who's going to have jurisdiction. So the most common example is when a non-Indian contractor goes onto the reservation. Under our law, the contractor's excise tax falls on the contractor, and it's up to them to pass on the cost of that if they want to. So if a non-Indian contractor is going onto the reservation and they're going to build a building, then we have to go through what's known as the Bracker analysis to determine if we can collect state taxes from that non-Indian contractor. And the common examples of where we clearly don't is if it's a tribal government building, a school, something where there's a high government interest, then we are preempted under the Bracker test from collecting that tax, even though it's a non-Indian who is doing the work. Talking about taxation, follows the Montana general rules and exception. Again, we have to apply the Bracker balancing test for non-Indians. Off-reservation activity is taxable by the state. And so, like Senator Bradford pointed out, for criminal jurisdiction, if the conduct is outside of reservation boundaries, it's subject to state criminal jurisdiction. Well, the same is true for taxation purposes. If the activity is occurring outside of the reservation, it's taxable, even if it's by the tribe. So if one of the tribes goes outside of the reservation to make a purchase, or they conduct a business, and I'm not aware of any in South Dakota that are conducting business outside of reservation boundaries, but there are tribes elsewhere in the United States that have businesses located outside their tribal boundaries. When they're outside the tribal boundaries, they're fully subject to state taxation. The United States Supreme Court has ruled that Indians must assist in the collection of taxes. Almost all of those cases deal with cigarettes. And so if a tribal member owns a smoke shop in Indian country, there's a whole line of United States Supreme Court cases that say for sales made to non-Indians, those sales are subject to state taxation. So even though it's an Indian who owns the business, when they sell an item to a non-Indian, the Supreme Court opinions say that, that the state can collect the tax for the sales made to non-Indians, and the Indian retailer is supposed to help us collect that tax. And then you also may have concurrent taxation by both the state and tribe. And so there are some circumstances where if you're doing business on the reservation, both the state and the tribe may legitimately collect a tax against against the non-Indian who might be doing business there. In the taxation area, we have entered into a tax compacts with a number of our tribes, and under the tax compacts, basically the tribe adopts a taxation system that is similar to the state system. The agreement sets out what percentage of split of those taxes will go to the tribe, what will go to the state, and the state basically acts as the collectors for the tribe. Family affairs, divorces, marriages, those type of situations, the court has found that there is a strong tribal interest. Again, that goes to the internal relationships of the tribe. So if you get married under tribal law and you go through a divorce under the tribal court system, there's a strong tribal interest in those type of situations, whether you're an Indian or a non-Indian. And then tribal membership, internal relations, and tribal offices have the strongest tribal interest. Other areas where jurisdiction comes up, the Indian Child Welfare Act. I think you've all heard quite a bit about the Indian Child Welfare Act. That basically gives the tribe an opportunity to become involved in certain circumstances involving children and the placement of children. The Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, that's the federal act that allows the tribes to negotiate compacts to conduct gaming at their casinos. And then liquor. The interesting thing about liquor is under federal law, it is a federal crime to sell liquor within Indian country unless you're in compliance with both state and tribal liquor codes. And that applies whether you're a non-Indian or an Indian. You need to be in compliance with both state and tribal liquor codes, or it's a federal crime if you're not. And then just a little bit about what we're doing in the Attorney General's office in Indian country. Since we moved into our new building, and we now have the capacity to expand our law enforcement training, since 2007, we have certified 25 officers from four different tribes. So they have gone through our academy and they have received state certification. We currently participate in the Safe Trails Task Force. That is a cross-jurisdictional, multi-jurisdictional task force made up of state officials, tribal officials, federal officials. And it was originally designed to try and stop some of the drug traffic that was going on. Persons who deal in drugs learn to find where the jurisdictional holes are. And so what we found are there were persons involved in the drug trade who were using the jurisdictional boundaries between Indian country and non-Indian country to their advantage. Whether they were dealing with tribal authorities, state authorities, or federal authorities, they were using Indian country to kind of create a safe harbor for their activities. And so we created the Safe Trails Task Force that's made up of officials from all of those jurisdictions in order to investigate and follow drug crimes wherever they might be located in South Dakota. That has recently expanded to also include a child sex predator program. Also, the State Forensics Laboratory, and again, as a result of our new building and the fact that we now have a state-of-art forensics lab, we are now doing the forensic work for Indian country in South Dakota. Prior to that, for crimes committed in Indian country, that evidence all needed to be sent out of state to other laboratories, and we are now doing that work here in South Dakota. We have a full-time serologist under the Child Sexual Predator Program. We have two lab staff in direct support of Indian Country cases. And in 2009, we examined 441 pieces of evidence for 84 different crimes that were committed in Indian country. And we do that at no cost of the tribes. We have applied for and received some federal grants to help fund that, but when we're doing that work for the tribes, that's at no cost to them, just like it's at no cost for local government when we do their forensic lab work. Also, we have established what's known as a child abduction response team, or a CART team. That's a team of law enforcement officials and other search and rescue type officials all over the state who can come together in an emergency to respond to a child abduction. We also have members who are representative of the tribal governments and federal officials, and so if there's a child abduction in Indian country, our CART team can also respond to that abduction and provide assistance. The final area that I wanted to mention, and I forgot to put on my slides, is South Dakota is one of three states in the country that has a Native American art program. It falls under our consumer protection statutes, and it basically is a violation of our consumer protection laws that if you are selling art and claiming it's Native American art when it's really not, that's a state law violation. South Dakota, Arizona, and New Mexico are the only three states in the country that have that law. We work closely with the Indian Arts and Crafts Council, which is part of the U.S. Department of the Interior, and we have done a joint brochure with them that's goes out to the consumers, and you might see some of these around, especially during the summer during tourist season. But basically, it explains what the Indian Arts and Craft Act is, what your rights as a consumer are, and what the violations are, and it provides contact information for both our Consumer Protection Division and for the Indian Arts and Crafts Board in the Department of Interior. And that's all the information I have as part of my presentation, but I know that's a lot of stuff that I threw at you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. This is a complicated area, so.
Anybody? Senator Aller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would it be possible to have that presentation that you just gave us? Could you have that emailed?
Tom and Rita have that. So.
They do. Okay, good.
Charlie, this is a little off the subject, but is there any what's come about the bill we passed and dealing with the transfer of right-of-ways or land that's coming up July 1? Could you give us a little...
That bill was, what, passed 2 years ago, I believe? No, it was the session before. I'm pretty sure it was the 2009 session. I think it was the 2009 session. It was like Senate Bill 109 or 119, something along those lines. Both Flandreau and Bennett County asked for an official attorney general opinion. I will tell you that attorney general opinion process was very lengthy, and I believe we just issued an opinion on that not very long ago, within the past month or two, that pointed out some additional problems with the transfer of roads in Indian country, and I would be happy to get Tom a copy of that opinion.
Okay,
but there are issues still with the road transfers.
Still issues, yes. Even though that I know the chairman just yesterday I met with the Bennett County chairman, of course, and he's concerned about that, and of course I was very interested in Mallette County too is in the same process, and I think there's might be a little difference between the two roads, but one's in the middle of a state highway and the other one is just a county road. And
just so you know, Senator Bradford, Attorney General Jackley went down to Pine Ridge and he actually met with some of the community leaders at Allen. I think it was about the end of April, you might recall, to talk specifically about the Allen Road issue. And he also met with the tribal council later that same day or the next morning. And he's committed to trying to work out that issue. He met with the Bennett County officials, and we're hopeful that we can get that issue worked out eventually. I know that both Bennett County and the Oglala Sioux Tribe have been trying to get that Allen Road situation fixed for a long time.
Okay, if there's not any more questions, I think it's our break time.
Follow-up question. With that
Senator Maher
opinion of the Attorney General with that road right away, is there going to be legislative changes that need to be made?
Mr. Chairman,
if so, have they been drafted, or do we need to work on that, or what's the status of all that?
Senator Maher, the problem comes down to the criminal jurisdiction issue. Even if the road transfers, that does not change the jurisdiction. So that portion of the Allen Road, for example, that runs over non-Indian fee lands, even though the road might transfer from the county to the tribe, for criminal jurisdiction purposes, that land would still be subject to state jurisdiction, which causes an issue that I don't know that the legislature can resolve. Because the state of South Dakota can't change that criminal jurisdiction, only Congress can.
Thank you. Is there anything? Representative Wink.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I would just like to thank Mr. McGuigan for his presentation. He took a very complicated issue and with his presentation presented it in a form that is more understandable, at least to me, and I think to the rest of the committee. And it's give us a basic understanding anyhow of how everything is tied together and why we hear some of the things we do with particular issues and because of the varying jurisdictions and so on. And so I'd just like to thank you for your presentation and making it to where it's a little more understandable to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wink. And if you or any of the other committee members or anyone of the legislature has additional questions or concerns, I'd be more than happy to visit with you. I know Attorney General Jackley would be more than happy to visit with you. In our office, there's only about three of us who deal with these jurisdictional issues, and it is very complicated. And I will also tell you, I suspect that there will be some disagreement by other persons who with some of the things I told you today. So what I gave you is my view of the law. Like all areas of the law, people can disagree about it, and that's what keeps us lawyers employed. So.
Yeah, I too want to thank you, Charlie. Very good.
And
Charlie has always been very receptive to us down in the state's attorney's office. He's done an awful lot of work, research work for us and everything. He's been very, very good.
Thank you, Senator.
Brief synopsis of the correction issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I apologize, I'm kind of struggling with the technology here. I might try to start my presentation, and then I might try to see if I can get this thing to come up to you. I do have some hard copies of the presentation. I'll hand those out.
Well, we're going to allow you a great deal of flexibility. Okay.
there, but now it is. Okay. All right. All right, well, first of all, I really appreciate the opportunity to spend a little bit of time with the committee today and update the committee in terms of the activities that are going on specific to diversity and Native American issues within the correctional system. I had the opportunity almost exactly a year ago to address the committee. I think it was on June 9th of 2009, so I appreciate the opportunity to be able to do the update. I'm really following kind of the same outline that I did last time, and what I'm going to try to cover today is kind of the scope of the DOC's responsibilities, just to kind of set the stage a little bit again, talk about our numbers of Native American offenders, the numbers of offenders that we have, and then the numbers that are Native American, a little bit about what we're doing in terms of staff training on diversity, some of our offender programs specific to Native Americans, some of the prevention work on the juvenile side, and then some of the reentry work that we've been doing recently. Let me just see if I can get this to work here. If you can bear with me for just a minute, please. This is kind of weird because I have a black screen up here, so I'm having to use this screen as my screen, which is kind of disconcerting here. Let's see here. And everybody can see when I make a mistake, too. Which. Let's see if this is going to take just a minute. The first slide, it's actually on page 2, is just a recap of what our mission statement is. And, you know, I think when people think corrections, a lot of times they think prisons. And we're a lot more than that. And even our prison operations are a lot more than just locking people up. I think folks demand, and we demand of ourselves, a lot more than just locking people up. That's very short term in terms of public safety. Public safety is still our major concern. And sometimes we have to do that by locking folks up. But we also have to do that by working on transition services and community-based supervision. And we also do that by trying to impact changes in behavior, changes in conduct through evidence-based practices. And evidence-based practices are just those things that research says work in reducing recidivism. It's typically assessment-based services. You know, what I need to keep out of prison might be different than what somebody else needs. So it's taking a look at the individual and then having programs that meet what those needs are. And having programs that are relevant. You know, if a program is delivered to me and the examples that are given are so different than what my reality is, it's not very relevant to me. So that's where I think it really ties into what I'm going to talk to the committee about today, is the issue on cultural relevance, is the examples that we give and how we build scenarios when we do programming. We're trying to be more competent when it comes to dealing with the diversity. On page 3, it's just a map of the different facilities that we have in the state. Let's just see here. I think I got it. Thank you for the committee's patience with this. Okay, here we go. This is just a recap of where our facilities are. The Department of Corrections is in 17 communities throughout the state. The blue is the juvenile corrections agents' offices. The red is adult, both parole and institutions. And then the blue also has Star Academy out in Custer. Just as a reminder, and I think all the committee members probably know this, but in South Dakota, we're responsible for the adult prisons, adult parole, kids that are put in Department of Corrections placement through Star Academy or private placement, and then kids on aftercare. Folks that are on probation are under UJS in South Dakota, and the jails are run typically by the county or in some cases by the city. So just to kind of set the stage with that. This is our average daily population for our adult inmates, and this reflects all of the folks that are inmates regardless of what facility they're in, whether it's the state penitentiary in Sioux Falls, the Mike Durfee State Prison at Springfield, or the women's prison here in Pierre. So this is the whole works. Those of you that are on the Appropriations Committee have seen these slides a lot. This just shows what our actual average daily count was from fiscal year 1999 through fiscal year 10. And the fiscal year 10 numbers go through the end of May. So it's 11 months worth of average daily count. We're growing, but we're growing at a really moderate pace. The last 4 years have been very good compared to what the years before that were. The years before that, we would grow anywhere from 3% on the low end up to 11% on the high end. And over the last 4 years, it's been much more moderate. I think we're going to grow at about a rate of 2% this year between FY9 and FY10. The year before that, we grew by 1%. And the 2 years before that, we actually went down by 1%. So that's when I say it's been very, very moderate, that's very positive. Why does the population change? And for us, really the two things that we look at is how many people that we have coming in the door and then how long do they stay. And for women, between FY9 and FY10, the number of new commitments and the number of parole violators are down. At the rate, if we keep with the rate that we're going, probably about 24 fewer over the course of the year, which for women, that's pretty significant because that's enough to make a difference. For the men, it's kind of a mixed bag. Our parole violators are down, but our new commitments are up a little bit. We're not having as many people come in the door as we have in years past. Our length of stay is steady to down, which is also good. Women on the average are doing 14 months before their first release, and that's unchanged between FY09 and FY10. So far in FY10, men are doing 20 months to first release. Last year it was 21 months, so it's down a tiny bit. And those are markers that explain why our population is staying pretty level. This is our parole population. Over the last several years, our parole population has grown quite a bit. Again, this is through May for FY10 that we're having more and more folks out on parole. And again, this is really the way the new parole system is structured, is that folks do typically the bulk of their time under supervision in the community as opposed to in prison. And I say that with the caveat or with the understanding that many of our offenders are nonviolent offenders, and they do a smaller percentage of their time in prison versus on parole. This is the racial breakdown of our offenders, and this is as of the end of May. For adult inmates, about 29% of our adult inmates are Native American. 62% are Caucasian, about 6% African American, about 3% Hispanic. The breakdown for the folks by gender, I don't have this on the slide, but I'll just share that with the committee. The percentage of female inmates that are Native American is higher. It's 42% of our female inmates are Native American. 54% are white, 2% African American, and 2% either Hispanic or other. And then for the male inmates, it's 27% Native, 63% white, 6% black, and 4% other. So this 28.8% is the combination of the male and female put together. For the folks that are on parole, about 24% of our parolees are Native American, 67% Caucasian, 5% African American, and about 3% Hispanic. This next slide illustrates the number of youth that we have under the Department of Corrections jurisdiction. This shows 13 years of trends, and this includes folks that are in both placement and aftercare. The average daily count through May, which is kind of the light blue one, for FY10, is 832, and that's made up of 423 kids that are in placement and 409 that are on aftercare. you can see that our numbers that are in DOC have been going down over the years, which is a very positive trend. This is just a pullout of the last chart. This is just the kids that are on aftercare, and this is where you see that 409 on that light blue. And those are kids that have completed their placement, whether it be at Star Academy or at one of the private placements, and are out on supervision in the community under a JCA. It's like it's comparable to parole on the adult side, that they're on that period of supervision. I noticed I was off by one number, but the story is the same here. If you add up the number of Native American females at 111 and the number of Native males at 213, you'll realize it doesn't come up to 325. It comes up to 324. But as I said, the story is still the same. Our total youth, again, 817, and this is the breakdown. 325 of them are Native American youth. Back in 2003, when Tim Rice was appointed Secretary of the Department of Corrections by Governor Rounds, Governor Rounds and Secretary Rice really encouraged a strong effort in the Department of Corrections to be aware of and work on responding more effectively to diversity. And one of the first things that was formed was this cultural awareness group. And I think I briefed the committee on this last year as well. But the cultural awareness group is a group of staff that get together on a monthly basis. We just have a standing schedule that we have a cultural awareness group meeting once a month at a set time. And this is typically the chief officers of each of our facilities, like Doug Weber, Norbert Monen. So we typically have, you know, at least a couple of the wardens, a superintendent out at Star, a senior staff member from parole, our cultural activities coordinators. We have a cultural activities coordinator in each of our institutions, and DOC senior staff. We meet monthly. It's usually a telephone call, usually a conference call, and we deal with a variety of issues. Part of it is just sharing information, talking about the different cultural activities that are going on at the different institutions. Sometimes we do, you know, like troubleshooting, or if we're having issues with resources, or if we have policy issues, we talk about them. And we also use it usually as a training period too. For example, one of the ones that I sat in recently talked about poverty and the impact that poverty has in terms of how folks oftentimes will respond to things in their circumstances, and to be able to frame it in a poverty framework as opposed to a racial or a cultural. I mean, it's a focus on diversity. It's not just Native American, but it's just that we're all different, and there's this huge diversity out there, and trying to develop that. That appreciation and that understanding of it. The thing for me, too, that's very important with this cultural awareness group is the notion that if it's important, you spend time on it and you talk about it. And that's what the cultural awareness group helps us do, is it helps us keep it in the forefront, that it's something that we're working on, it's something that we're trying to continue to improve in terms of our effective response to diversity and to different cultures. There's also a tribal liaison program, and I'll switch to my next slide here. This is the listing of the current tribal liaisons. The tribal liaisons attend powwows in the institution. Sometimes we'll lead sweats. They do presentations for the offenders, visit with the offenders on a one-on-one basis or on a group basis, and facilitate contact between the state agency and tribal government. And this is the listing of the tribal liaisons. I believe there's seven active tribal liaisons right now, or from seven tribes. In some cases, it's shared responsibilities. For our staff, in terms of our staff training and our staff exposure to cultural diversity, pre-service and annual in-service contains segments on cultural diversity awareness and interpersonal relationship training. All staff have to go through in-service training before they go on the job with DOC, and then there's annual in-service training requirements for all staff, too. So that is built into that calendar. We also try to have folks have exposure to this at our monthly all-staff meetings, where they talk about the Lakota ceremonies and things on cultural sensitivity, for example, the power of words. These monthly staff meetings, as I said, are just what they sound like, where we try to get all the staff together and brief policy issues and reminders on things. We also do a diversity conference in the summertime, which is an opportunity to take our associate wardens, our cultural activities coordinators, and our training staff, and expose them to different community things. For example, they've gone to the synagogue, they've gone to, you know, powwows, to just get out in the community and experience some of these things that maybe they haven't in the past. So that's what we call our diversity conference. We continue to use the recruitment efforts to try to get a diverse staff. Job fairs, advertising, and newspapers that have a circulation in the reservation communities, attend NAACP meetings, go to a disability job fair, use the diversity conference to make some of those connections as well. And then finally on this slide, I've just listed the workshop attendance as a kind of a laundry list of some of the things that staff have attended in the last year in terms of training on these various topics.
Lori, you said recruitment for staffing. Can you, I know it changes from month to month, but percentage-wise, on an ongoing basis, could you tell us percent that you try, our goal that you have for Native, and what have you attained? Can you?
We wish it was higher, I can tell you that. But what I would like to do, if it would be all right, is I don't have those numbers at my ready, but if I could get them to Tom and for distribution to the committee.
Yeah, or if you just have ballpark off the top of your head numbers. If you feel comfortable with that, if you don't, you can
get
it to us.
I think I can go back and get my folder. I think I've got some kind of dated material. I think I've got a spreadsheet in there from probably about 2 years ago. I can go pull that, but that's it's not great. But I, without looking at the spreadsheet, I don't want to blurt out what I'm thinking the percentages either, because I don't trust my memory real well. So, okay. I will follow up, though, and get it. The next slide is a listing of the activities for offenders within the adult system. The previous slide was really more focused on staff training. And this is just a list of the activities that are available for inmates to participate in. Pipe ceremony, church, prayer ties, sweats, drum group, and the classes are typically weekly occurrences. There's also special sweats that an inmate can request if there's something specifically going on, like a family illness or a death in the family, or to commemorate Native American Day or, you know, Wounded Knee. They can ask for special sweats for certain circumstances. The community access for medicine men, spiritual leaders, and the tribal liaisons, they come in and lead the ceremonies, as I said, on the tribal liaison slide. They also meet with the inmates. We also have facilitated where they can have access with proper clearance to go to the secure housing unit and the administrative segregation unit, which that gives them access to the inmates who wouldn't typically be able to participate in some of the programs out in general population. We typically have powwows at the institutions 2 to 4 times a year is what the typical schedule is. We've also worked on the group and individual property provisions and have a list there of some examples of some of the cultural specific property that we make provisions for inmates to have access to. And then, as I think I briefed the committee last year, the funeral and bedside trip visits to reservation communities were reinstated several years ago. You know, if there's a terminal illness or a death in an immediate family, that an inmate with the proper clearance can access, you know, can go home for that bedside visit or for that funeral. There's been Native American chemical dependency treatment going in the institution for the last several years. This, you know, the Department of Human Services provides the CD treatment for both adults and juveniles within the Department of Corrections. And the Red Road Approach to Wellness is the basis of the program. It was developed by Gene Thin-Elk and the late Dwayne Mackey. They also use the Red Road to Wellbriety from the White Bus Bison is also used. It's available at the Women's Prison, the State Pen in Sioux Falls, the Yankton Unit, and the Mike Durfee State Prison at Springfield. Also new as part of our reentry efforts is that we're trying to develop the capacity to have Native American specific chemical dependency treatment in the community. The recidivism rate for Native Americans is higher than it is for Caucasians. Our recidivism rate for just overall, our 12-month recidivism rate is right around that 30% mark. For Native Americans, it's about 42%. And so we have to do something different. We can't expect that we're going to impact recidivism if we keep doing the same old, same old. And so one of the things, you know, chemical dependency issues are just a huge issue across the board, whether it be a Native American offender or a Caucasian offender. Vast majority of the offenders have CD issues. But we wanted to develop the capacity to be able to have Native American-specific services in Sioux Falls and in Rapid City, because that's still where most people parole to. And so we do have, with the help of the Department of Human Services and these local providers, the Glory House provides treatment in Sioux Falls, and we recently came to an agreement with Southern Hills in Rapid City to provide Native American-specific chemical dependency treatment. So when we have folks that are coming out of prison who need either aftercare or treatment who are Native American, that we can refer them to those programs. Likewise, if we have a Native American offender who's on parole in the community and is having trouble and they need CD treatment, we can refer them to these programs as a way of avoiding having to come back. Department of Human Services also continues to work with the tribal programs for community-based services to allow Native American parolees to attend services on their various reservations. Most offenders that need CD treatment, we try to get them through treatment before they get out on parole. Not everyone does, because sometimes there's just either their time is too short or they have different things going on where they're not able to access treatment. But usually we get most of them through. I think it's somewhere between 10 and 15% of them that need treatment don't get through before they parole. So in some cases, they need to actually have treatment when they get out on parole. And in all cases, even if they've gotten treatment in the institution, we want them to have aftercare when they go into the community. So there's that continuation of the services. So they're trying to develop the capacity to have those services in the reservation communities.
Lori, would it be possible for you to get me any breakdown on where two things, where they come from and what tribal affiliation on all of them? I mean, the males, female. And you don't have to do that now or nothing, but
I think we
maybe
should be
you
able
could
to
do that for me. Maybe some of the committee might be interested in that.
So the county that they were committed from,
yeah,
and what tribe they were,
yeah,
affiliated with.
I'm saying, like, if they come out of Pennington County or if they come out of Lyman County or Bennett County, or where they originate from, and then what, because I'm kind of curious if there is some in there that are of, say, Montana tribes. Mm-hmm. That's
okay.
Thank you.
Yep. Slide 15 is a list of the cultural activities in the juvenile institutional system. I had just gone through kind of what was available in the adult system. For the kids that are out at STAR, they access the Crazy Horse Summer Series presentations at the monument there. participate in the annual Native Voice Film Festival. They access, Stray access Humanities Council presenters in the past, and typically, based on the information I had, they usually have about three of them a year, and usually two of them are Native American specific. Try to structure the history class at the high school that they operate there at Star to be culturally sensitive and to reflect the history lessons. Charles Whiteout comes on campus usually a couple of times a year and presents the seven virtues and values to live by, and then job fair presentations. Kids typically are not in placement nearly as long as adults are in prison, so it's a little bit of a different, it's actually a very different setting than it is for the adults, and I think some of the activities reflect that they typically access the community more for some of the cultural things rather than having to bring all of the cultural activities right to the institution. The next couple of slides talk about the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act and the programming that goes along with that. In 2003, South Dakota renewed its participation in the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Program. And this brings about $600,000 annually to South Dakota. This is a voluntary grants program, and if the state complies, we receive this federal funding to support juvenile justice projects. And what I'm really moving into in the point of my presentation now is some of the prevention work that the Department of Corrections is somewhat involved with through this program. The program requirements under the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act are really four. The first is removal of kids from adult jails. Second is sight and sound separation of juveniles from adults when they are in secure custody. Third is the removal of status offenders from secure custody. And status offenders are kids that are runaways or typically curfew violations, things that it wouldn't be a problem except they're underage. And then also, fourthly, the program requirement is to address disproportionate minority contact within the juvenile justice system. The Council of Juvenile Services is a state advisory group that administers the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act grants program, and it's a 20-member council, and that council is administered by the Department of Corrections. And the council determines how these grant funds are going to be used. And there's a couple of issues with these grant funds that tie directly to tribal and cultural concerns. And one of them you'll see on this first slide here was the disproportionate minority contact interventions. Through this money, the council funds local disproportionate minority contact work groups and intervention projects in Sioux Falls and in Rapid City and in Sisseton. And there's just a little bit of text on there. In Sioux Falls, it's a diversion program as an alternative to formal charges. This is done by LSS in Sioux Falls, and they get referrals from the state's attorney, from Minnehaha County State's attorney, work with the youth and the family as an alternative to having to go to court and link them to services. So it's trying to keep the kids out of the court system. In Rapid City, there's a community-based prevention specialist. This is a person who works through an agency called Sanity. Basically works with the parents and kids who are having trouble. They're referred by schools or court service officers, et cetera, and primarily work one-on-one with the youth and the family. And then in Sisseton, this is a partnership between the school and the local mental health agency to provide those services that are listed up there, the school liaison officer, the Kids Smart program, and violence reduction program. So these are the three areas where the disproportionate minority contact interventions are currently operating. There's also a statewide juvenile justice culturally competency training project that's in development, and in fact, they're doing their first pilot training today in Sioux Falls. And this is training for court services staff, juvenile corrections agents, and detention staff in areas on just, you know, kind of the, first of all, what do the numbers say, kind of the data piece of it, and then also the cultural piece of it, and the diversity, and then the Native American cultural training. The trainers are Craig Howe, Jennifer Wagner, who's our lead cultural activities coordinator, and Roland Laudenberg, who's our researcher on a lot of our grants. So that's being piloted today in Sioux Falls for the staff that work with youth in the criminal justice system. Again, to develop that competence, to enhance that competence into cultural matters. There's also, under the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act activities, there's also a Native American grants program. And in the current grant period, each tribe was eligible to apply for these funds. And the tribes that did apply and receive the $25,000 grants were Cheyenne River, Standing Rock, Flandreau, Rosebud, and Sisseton. And the tribes use these to fund juvenile probation services. And then effective this coming July 1, the tribes that are currently receiving grants will be eligible to receive continuation funding. So, the final thing that I'd like to highlight in my presentation is some of the reentry initiatives that are going on in the Department of Corrections. Back in March of 2009, Governor Rounds appointed folks to a reentry council. And the purpose of this council was to really highlight and work on recidivism reduction among adult offenders. And the method of working on recidivism reduction was to focus more on how we work on prisoners reentering, moving from prison to the community. The idea with this council is that the needs of these folks that are transitioning, it's much more than just corrections. It's, you know, when a person gets sent to corrections, that doesn't mean that corrections can be the be-all and the end-all for all of their needs, because their needs were there before they came to us, and they're probably going to exist to a certain level when they leave, whether it be a chemical dependency issue, a housing issue, a job issue, a health issue, a mental health issue, all of those things. So this reentry council brings the cabinet secretaries of all of the departments that really are involved with prisoner reentry, brings them together. Roger Campbell, the Director of State Tribal Government Relations, is a member of this council, as are the mayors in Rapid City and Sioux Falls. So collaboration is really a key thing with what we're trying to do with reentry. With reentry, we're really trying to, I think it reflects the recognition of the impact that our correctional handprint has on communities. You know, it's not just that it's really expensive, and it is. I mean, our budget is $106 million this year, I think. It's terribly expensive, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. It's expensive to the state. It's also very, very expensive to communities. It's expensive to the individual. It's expensive to the families. And it's just not a monetary expense. It's also an expense in terms of lost participation in community and lost participation in relationship. So it's just really elevating the focus on reentry in terms of what we do. Half of our prison population typically is a recidivist when we look at them. And to me, that monkey's on our back. You know, when the person first comes in and they're coming from the court system, corrections does a little bit with prevention, but mainly what our role has been traditionally is deal with them once they're committed to us. But once we have them and they come back, that's, as I said, that's when that monkey's on my back, I think. And that's where we really are convicted in terms of having to do something. So we're really, you know, if we can reduce recidivism, we're going to have a big impact on the number of folks that are in our state prison system. And as I talked about before, the recidivism rate for Native American offenders is higher than it is for white offenders. The numbers that I have up on this slide are actually the 2007 releases, where we had a 29.9% overall recidivism, and then for Natives it was 42.4%. I've already talked about the Native American chemical dependency treatment through the Glory House and Southern Hills Alcohol and Drug Center in Rapid City to try to provide some specific services. what we're trying to do is really pool our efforts and our resources and provide services and address barriers. Some of the things that we're doing is looking at some of our policy revisions to minimize parole violations and try to enhance access to services for things that stabilize Native American parolees in particular. Just as kind of an example, you know, traditionally we've said you got to have a place to live and you got to have a job, that those are kind of the two standard things before we're going to approve somebody for parole. But we're starting to try to take a little broader look on that. You know, if we have somebody who is paroling back home but there's not a job back home, but that's where all their support system is, that's where their family is, maybe they have a wife and a couple of kids, that's where their home is. To insist that they have to parole to a more urban area because they have that job and not reconnect with that family and that positive support system sometimes is not the wisest thing to do. Sometimes that person is going to have a better chance of making it if we look at that job thing in a little broader context and we say, what are going to be the insulating factors for this person making it, and to try to not be so, you got to have a job and you got to have a place to live and that's that. So I think that that's just an example of that. We're also trying to kind of slow down some of the parole revocations sometimes. If we have somebody in the community who's having trouble, not that we're not going to respond to the violation. We respond to every violation, but you can respond in a lot of ways other than bringing a person back to the state penitentiary. And sometimes what we're trying to do is they may end up in jail for a period of a couple of weeks even while we're trying to develop additional resources in the community for them to stay out in the community rather than pull them all the way back to the prison. So we're just trying to look at a lot of things. It's not only with this recidivism reduction, it's not only the programs for the offenders, but it's also the policies that we have within the Department of Corrections, and then having that overlay of the cultural sensitivity, too, in terms of how we're applying those policies. We do have a federal second chance reentry grant that we got. It's a one-year grant. We have gotten an extension on that, and that will run, the first year will run through March of 2011, and then there's 2 years of reauthorization funding that's available that you don't ever want to be overconfident, but I think we're pretty well positioned to get years two and three funding for that, to continue to look at providing these resources to strengthen reentry. I don't have material on my slide on this, but there's also a juvenile reentry grant that I just want to talk about a little bit before I close. We also have a juvenile reentry grant that's a three-year program. Really the same goals is once we have a child committed to DOC and we move them to aftercare so they don't end up with an aftercare revocation or having to be recommitted to the Department of Corrections. And the focus of that reentry program is in Sioux Falls and Rapid City, and it's to provide an alternative school setting and employment development for those kids in Sioux Falls and Rapid City. School is a huge protective factor for kids when they're coming out. If we can get them in school and keep them in school, it's not only that they're learning, but it's keeping them out of trouble. They're not out goofing around if they're in school. And so if they can get engaged in school and stay in school and have some success, they do much, much better than if they are not in school. And so we're focusing the reentry efforts kind of clustered around the alternative school setting in Sioux Falls and Rapid City. That's what I have. So if there's any questions, the committee.
Lori, I wanted to ask you about, I probably have more than most because I've had several of my family in prison and some in now, but in the what I found in the work program, for instance, in certain work programs, they take a big part of what the guy makes. Where does that? Is there any differentiation between programs where they don't like? Take half or more of what they make for where they're incarcerated? Is there?
Yeah, I don't have an easy answer to this. We have a financial responsibility policy that is structured for this. I'll just try to talk about it a little bit and try to answer your question. Inmates typically, there's a couple different work programs for inmates. Probably the largest is community service work or institutional support. For purposes of this answer, I'm going to lump those two in together. The community service work are the people who typically are out working in the community. You'll see them in the orange shirts. They may work for a Department of Transportation or the landfill out in Rapid City. You see some of the women in the blue polo shirts here in the Capitol building. Those are community service workers. Those folks get a quarter an hour is what their wages are. Our institutional support folks are people who would work like in the laundry or in food service or janitor work in the institution. They also get a quarter an hour. So that's why I'm lumping those two together. They get a quarter an hour. There are a couple of groups of inmates that have the opportunity to make more than that. There's private sector prison industries employees in the institution where they're actually working for a private company in the institution and making prevailing wage. And then there's inmates on work release. Work release inmates are usually within a year of getting out, and they're out in the community getting their own competitive job. I mean, they're approved for work release, and they go out and they have to find their own job. They may be, you know, they work really a whole wide variety. They may be working in a restaurant. They may be working in a manufacturing plant, maybe working construction, maybe working an office job. And, of course, their wages would vary depending upon what the job is, but they would be making at least minimum wage. Okay, so that's kind of the background with it. For all inmates, they get, $140 a month out of money that comes in, either through what they've earned or what people, their family has sent in. They get $140 for their spending money. That's their commissary money. They can spend $35 a week in commissary, and that's for things like, typically it's hygiene supplies, stamps, envelopes, some snack food, those sorts of things. So that comes, we don't take anything until they get $140 in a month. If they get more than $140 in a month, then half of it has to go to their court-ordered obligations and half of it goes towards savings for release. And court-ordered obligations are things like child support, restitution, fines, fees, those sorts of things. So for the quarter an hour guys, unless they've got somebody sending money in, they're never going to get past that 140. I mean, that's, you just don't make enough. For the work release in the private sector, though, a lot of them do get more than that. Of course, more than 140 a month. And then it splits up between those court-ordered obligations and their savings.
I guess what I'm talking about, Lori, is here's a young man. There's two young men in the prison or in the jail, and they both got work release. One guy's got a wife and two children on the outside, and the other guy has nobody. But when the check comes, they take the same amount away from the guy who has a family as they do from the guy who has nobody. And I guess that's kind of what I visited a little bit with you about some of the discretions that I thought, but it's pretty much cut and dried. You pay so much no matter what. I mean.
Yeah, and with work release, they do pay room and board. Yeah. Which is the thing that I did not say that I should have, is that we do require folks that are out working on work release to pay room and board right off the top, and that's probably.
Yeah, it sometimes it gets to a point, is the old saying about the welfare recipients, you know, that said, I go to work, I lose everything, so why go to work?
And, you know, sometimes in those cases, what I find works the best is I always want to know, well, tell me who it is, and so I can run the scenario and take a look at it. Because, you know, from my position, a lot of times I think, well, child support's supposed to be the first priority, so it should be leveling it off. But sometimes you do have to kind of look underneath and say, okay, in this specific situation, how's that money moving through and what are we seeing with it? So,
Any questions? Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Laurie, I'd like to pursue a little bit the in your initial numbers of in prisons inmates that are incarcerated. Since 2006, it looks like the leveling off, basically, or at least less of an incline. And I'm sure there are many factors that probably are involved, whether it's the number of crimes, the way the court systems are handling them, or the influence of meth may be less, or whatever. But what do you think the major, is there one factor that sticks out? Are there other alternative programs that are being used now, and they're just simply not going into the prison system because of these alternative programs? How do you account, basically, for that leveling off since 2006, if there is a factor?
Yeah. There are probably multiple factors. I sound really cynical when I say this first thing, so I'll apologize up front. Part of it is people are just getting older, generally. The bulk of the people, and people who, the highest risk for crime is when you're younger. You settle down when you get older. So the fact that the cross-section of the population, I think the average age is going up, that in and of itself has a leveling typically of the crime rates as we get older. That's one of the things, you know, you just see over and over again. That is, once a person hits 40 or so, you know, they kind of settle down. I think that there has been quite a bit more work over the last couple of years on evidence-based programming, trying to, you know, we've shown that if you do good program, you can make a difference on that. Our meth treatment program has a 12% recidivism rate, which is phenomenal. So we've shown that, you know, that you can make a difference on that. There's been, I think, additional work, you know, prevention efforts. There's been additional work by UJS with their drug court and some of their diversion programs, some of the stuff that we've been doing in the institution. I think those things all have little influences that when you combine it, you start seeing some of that. So probably a multitude.
And how do we compare with the surrounding states or even nationwide? Are these numbers reflected across the country doing about the same thing, or are we doing something better than some of the other states that we're rising to the top in some of these areas and they're not?
Generally, and this is very general, generally this is fairly reflective of what's going on in the country. There are outliers. You know, there's some that are reducing a lot more, and there's some that are continuing to grow. But generally, the prison population over the last couple of years has leveled off to declined.
One other thing, Gloria, could you give us any kind of a report on the status quo of the Rapid City new facility? Where's that at?
Sure. The new facility, which is located about a third of a mile south of the temporary unit on Creek Drive, it's the former American Concrete building. We had purchased that building, and then there was some legal action that was taken. The Supreme Court recently, or not so recently, a couple months ago, ruled in favor of the state on that. So this summer, we are going to be starting the construction. You know, we're going to be putting parole offices out there and the housing unit for the offenders. The parole offices are going to be the first stage of it. That's about, you're catching me cold here, but I want to say that's about a 4-month construction project. And then the housing unit project will be about a 16-month construction project. And we will probably be starting that this summer. Yeah, I would.
Well, I want to thank you, Lori, for coming. And I have always been very responsive to our Native American issues. And I really, really appreciate your time and the information, and I'm sure there will be things in the future before that we'll be discussing. But especially I want to thank you. You've always been really great.
Okay, thank you for the opportunity, and I will.
Better turn my mic on. Reconvene, and we'll have a discussion on education issues overview by Lou Ann Werdahl, Director of the Office of Indian Education in the Department of Education. And Lou Ann, I'll turn it over to you. Yeah. And I don't know if that mic's on, but turn it on if it isn't.
Sometimes the press it, sometimes the brighter.
Oh, there it goes. Okay, well, thank you for inviting me here to give you an update on the Indian Education Office. I was originally going to do a PowerPoint demonstration for you, but my laptop got killed yesterday, so I'm just going to do a narrative report today. Anyway, thank you for inviting me here. Dear friends and relatives, Ambetu Washday. In the Lakota language, that means good day. I would like to take this time to introduce myself as the Indian Education Director for South Dakota. My name is Lou Ann Petty Werdahl, and I'm an enrolled tribal member of the Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate. My mother was Phyllis Owens Petty, and she was from the Enemy Swim District of the Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate. And my father is Lee Petty, and he is an enrolled tribal member of the Turtle Mountain Chippewa. I am very pleased and honored to be in this position, and I take my responsibility as director very seriously. Before I get into my report, I would just like to share a little bit about my background with you. For most of my educational career, I have either taught or lived on the Pine Ridge Reservation for the last 20 years. And in that time, I've been a teacher, counselor, and freshman principal, and primarily worked on the Pine Ridge Reservation. And then in the last 6 or 7 years, after becoming involved with Gear Up, I was expanding into schools across the state of South Dakota and was very actively involved in the Gear Up program in 24 middle schools and 14 high schools across the state. A little bit about my educational experience was I graduated with a bachelor's from Chadron State College in Chadron, Nebraska. Got my master's degree in educational administration from Oklahoma State University in Norman, Oklahoma. So I'm a Sooner fan also, which causes problems for me back in my home state of Nebraska at times. And I'm presently working on my superintendent certification with Montana State University through the iLEAD program. And in South Dakota, as you all know, we have some big challenges when it comes to American Indian education. We have a huge achievement gap between Native students and non-Native students in both the reading and math curriculum areas. The graduation rate of our American Indian students in public schools is right around 60% compared to 88% for all of the other students in South Dakota. In addition, if one looks at the graduation rates reported on the BIE website, our BIE high schools report graduation rates that range from a low of 28% to a high of 87%. Average composite ACT scores for our American Indian students are more than 4 points behind the state average for all students. Thus, not only do our people struggle within the educational system, they struggle in other areas such as health, economics, and overall well-being. For example, last year on the Pine Ridge Reservation alone, there were 9 suicides. A typical victim is usually a young man between the ages of 15 and 25. The statistical picture for our American Indian people is discouraging at best. However, we have implemented certain projects to change the educational picture for our students. It will take time, effort, and resources in the right hands to begin to correct some of these challenges. I've outlined below some of the major initiatives that the South Dakota Department of Education has implemented to address the above issues. One of the programs that we have successfully run for the last 5 years is Gear Up South Dakota. It's funded by the U.S. Department of Education, and in 2005, the South Dakota State Department of Education received one of 27 state gaining early awareness and readiness for undergraduate programs, awarded throughout the United States. The federal grant award for the 6-year grant period is approximately $1.15 million a year for 6 years for a total of $6.9 million targeted for American Indian students. 2010-2011 will be the last year of this grant cycle, and we will soon be working on the rewrite. The main goal of this program is to increase the number of first-generation, low-income American Indian students who are prepared to enter and succeed in post-secondary education. The governor of South Dakota, M. Michael Rounds, designated the State Department of Education as the administrator of the GEAR Up grant. My office serves as project director and leads the GEAR Up program. We work with a diverse set of 24 middle and 14 high schools across the state that includes public schools, parochial schools, and BIE-funded schools. These schools are located across the state of South Dakota, encompassing an area of over 77,000 square miles. During the 2008-09 academic school year, the program served 3,500 students and 3,300 parents. In addition to the school year activities, GEAR Up also sponsors a six-week-long residential academic summer program at the School of Mines for approximately 250 9th through 12th graders who come from all across South Dakota. Another program we have within our department is the South Dakota College Access Challenge Grant. This also is funded by the U.S. Department of Ed. This program basically strives to meet two goals: increase students' and parents' knowledge of post-secondary education options, and increase the number of students who enroll in post-secondary institutions. Again, the governor of South Dakota, M. Michael Rounds, has designated my office, the Office of Indian Education, as the agency responsible for administering this program. Fiscal year funding for this initiative has now increased to $1.5 million a year for the next 5 years, for a total of $7.5 million directed towards low-income children in the state. During the 2008-09 academic school year, this program served approximately 2,059 students, 687 parents. At that time, when we're looking at those numbers, that formula funding was extremely different than the $1.5 million now. It was only $330,000. We anticipate with this increased funding of $1.5 million a year to significantly increase those numbers across the state. Another program that we are working very closely with is the Core Concepts Planning Grant. This was funded by the Indian Land Tenure Foundation in 2008. And the main goal of this project is to define the core concepts essential to understanding and teaching the history and culture of the Ocheti Shekaume. These core concepts will then be used to modify existing and establish new state content standards. Senate Bill 1290 mandates that the Department of Education, in cooperation with the Indian Education Advisory Council, shall develop course content for curriculum and coursework in South Dakota American Indian history and culture. Another successful grant that was recently funded is the South Dakota Partnership for Teacher Quality. This also is funded by the U.S. Department of Education in October of 2009. And the primary purpose of this program is to increase student achievement in those K-12 schools by developing highly qualified teachers. To this end, the main goal of the South Dakota Teacher Quality Program are to develop those highly qualified teachers and place and retain those teachers within the high-need elementary and secondary South Dakota schools, and also develop and implement an innovative collaboration between an institute of higher education. We're working with the University of South Dakota, the high-need LEAs across the state, and those rural communities across the state that are being served by this grant, which is basically a lot of the schools on the reservation and other low-income communities across the state. Over 5 years, the South Dakota Teacher Quality Grant will prepare 75 new teachers to serve in 49 high-need schools located within 19 South Dakota school districts, with the majority of the communities served located on the reservation. The lives of our children depend on the work we'll be doing now and in the future. The most important responsibility of any society is to ensure the health, protection, and education of its young children. This is out of the Indian Nations at Risk Task Force. We have to continue to improve and create opportunities for our students to experience success. With this in mind, I am presently working on a strategic plan to address the four main goals of this administration. Number one is increase academic achievement for our Native American students. We want to recruit and retain more highly qualified teachers. We want to integrate the Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota culture into the state standards. And we're also working on creating a dynamic website for all things related to South Dakota Indian education. And when we're talking about a dynamic website, I would encourage all of you to take a look at Montana State's Office of Indian Education. That is something that we'd like to model our website after. It's a complete, comprehensive resource database for public educators across the state that they can access at any time. Very, very, it's just dynamic looking. So we've hired people to help us with that process. So thank you for taking the time to listen to me, and I look forward to hearing from all of you and working well with you. Thank you.
Anybody has for the good of one thing I guess that I'm interested in is what the where have we come? When I served in the House, excuse me, I was on the Education Committee, and all the time that Mr. Moore was in the Indian Education, I asked him to take a look at Red Clouds, what they were doing, because I should ask you, I don't know where you worked when you were on Pine Ridge.
Sure. Red Cloud was one of my schools.
Was it?
I've worked in Red Cloud also as a TRIO academic counselor for the University of South Dakota.
Yeah.
Basically was a traveling guidance counselor within that school system.
And, of course, I taught at Wolf Creek, you know, for
sure.
20 years. And the whole production of superior people in education was much higher at Red Cloud than it was at any of the other schools. And we all know that.
Sure.
And we're not. And so when every time we would have these discussions, I would ask him to discuss what they were doing. And, of course, on the state side, I got to say, you know, they're not too interested in parochial education there. Mm-hmm. They kind of shy away from that. But I do think that he did, Mr. Moore did visit with some of them. But there's some perplexing things I always use my grandson for an example. I mean, you look at him, boy. This boy is real. He's three quarters, and he's had all these problems because his father never did acknowledge him. His mother had problems, and anyway, my wife and I adopted him, and we sent him. He spent 2 years at Red Cloud. I stood in line to get him in Montessori.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I tell people about that. I lined up with everybody, kids, and even the superintendent of the agency was in line at that time to get his child in Montessori, and when it come to the cutoff, no matter who you were, no matter whether you were Senator Bradford or the superintendent, if you weren't in line in time for that cutoff, your child didn't get in. I mean, there was no, and you also paid a fee. And somehow, we are, this, and we ended up, my wife was, academically, she was dissatisfied. She sent 1 year to Wolf Creek, and very, very disheartening. But she wasn't unsatisfied with the education of Red Cloud. It was more there was a little bit of jealousy because he was very, very educational oriented. He didn't care much about basketball or any of these kind of things. So we sent him with my daughter up to Rapid City, and he went to Wilson, which, if you're familiar with Rapid City, Wilson School has approximately, it only goes to fifth grade, And it has probably, I'd say, 13 real Native American children in it. And this boy went in there, and he graduated fifth grade in the top five of his class, and almost every single one of those Native kids graduated in the top 10 or 15 of the kids in their grade level. He also tested 94 percentile in math, which is where they say, oh no, they just can't learn there. I'm trying to figure out what direction we're going into to get these kids a good education. And in my opinion, it has more to do with the parent to push the home life, the social atmosphere, than it does with the ability to learn. That's, and I don't know if you agree with that.
You know, I'm very familiar with all of the schools on the reservations. I've either worked with them very closely, and I know some programs that work very well and some that don't work at all. When you look at Red Cloud, and in regards to the state's perspective, it's a parochial school, thus they're a private school, and they don't go by the same rules and regulations that our public schools have to go by. You know, our public schools, they educate everybody, regardless of whether they're an IEP or whether they're in the 98th percentile. Red Cloud does a very good job with their students. However, they are a private school, so they have very strict entrance requirements. Across the board, you have to have a sixth grade. You have to have a sixth grade reading level to get into their school, their high school. When I was the freshman principal at Pine Ridge, I tested 160 freshmen coming into the school, and across the board, we had about 80% fifth grade reading level just coming into the high school. About 12% of our ninth graders were on grade level in their math. So that in itself creates a huge problem for your school. They're supposed to be coming into ninth grade at grade level, and almost 80% of them aren't. So you have to create those type of programs that's going to support those children when they come into your school. You have to do certain things for them, you know, because they're coming into a situation where they're already far behind. Now, Red Cloud, when they bring kids in, they test them, and they have some really good things going on. But they also can be very selective, Jim, as you know. You know, they'll take 70 freshmen their first year, and by the time even those kids are seniors, there'll still be only 40 seniors at Red Cloud, because throughout that process, they've let a lot of them go because of attendance records and different things like that. So by the time they graduate as seniors, those are the ones that are left, and they do a very good job with those remaining 40 seniors. They have very intense mentoring and counseling with all their counselors. The school classroom size are very small. Those all are very conducive to a very good educational environment. And then you go 5 miles down the road to Pine Ridge High School, where again, they're almost like a public school. They have to allow everybody to come in, and then they try to do the best they can with 160, 170 freshmen that aren't reading at grade level. They're not at math level, and they also are one of the poorest reservations in the United States. So you have a combination of, you know, low academic scores, not being at grade level, being at the lowest socioeconomic factors. Those all in themselves create these certain conditions that almost are going to guarantee that the kids are going to have a hard time in school. I totally agree with you. Regardless of our children's background, our schools have to create those type of strategies and interventions that can help our children be successful. And I can give you an example of when I was at Pine Ridge High School from 2002 to 2004, running my freshman academy, I was able to decrease the dropout rate from 80% down to 12% in just 1 year. And they gave me complete autonomy and freedom to do some of the things that I was doing. Unfortunately, being a BIE school, I also had 14 different bosses in 3 years because of the high turnover rate. So I was always having to explain this freshman academy prospect. I mean, the freshman academy was phenomenally successful, and they let me run it for about 3 years. Now everybody says, how did you do that, Luann? Well, it was pretty simple. It's not rocket science. We created cohorts for our students. We let all the freshmen come in 20-member cohorts. I knew exactly what their reading levels were, what their math levels were. I shared that data with the freshman teachers, so they all knew what our students were at. Another thing we also did was had intense mentoring and counseling for our students. Because, again, you got to consider the background of our students. A lot of them are coming from very, very poor families who cannot help them as much as they would like to. You can't tell me that our parents out there don't want to help our kids. All parents want to help their kids. They sometimes just aren't able to do that. So schools sometimes have to take on that added burden of becoming a parent. So we would do intense mentoring, intense counseling for these students. They would be in 20-member cohorts. They would only go to class all day long with just those 20 kids. They didn't even go to class with the rest of the freshmen. They went to math class together. They went to science class together. And we created a small learning family, if you would call it that. And I could ask John, where's Tom today? Well, his mom's really sick. He's home taking care of the kids. They actually became a small basic family, and they knew everything about one another. We also weren't so much textbook orientated, because again, you got to remember, they're coming into high school expected to read at a ninth grade reading level. We did a testing of all of our textbooks. We found out the only textbook in the whole school at a ninth grade reading level was our consumer science class. The computer class was at 11th grade reading level. Our freshman science book was at about a 10th grade reading level. So what we did was did professional development with our teachers and did some intense project-based learning. We were not so much textbook oriented because our kids were not at that regular reading level. So a combination of cohorts, doing a lot of project-based learning with the kids, but the real key was that the administrators let me implement a block schedule. Now, if I know that my kids can't read and do math very well, then that's something that I should focus on. Too many of our high schools have 7 periods that are 45 minutes long. I made the argument that I said, let me have these kids in 3 blocks in a day and let me have them in reading, math, and science. And then we'll flip-flop the next semester. I said, but I know my kids don't read very well, and I know they don't do math very well. So let's do 100 minutes blocks all semester and do it the second semester. By the time they had finished their freshman year, 69% of my freshmen were at grade level in math because they had 2 complete blocks that whole year in math. They went from a basic math to a pre-algebra class. Then a lot of them went on to 10th grade at grade level. Because I knew as an administrator that if you look at the data, you can adjust your schedule to accommodate those kids. So there are certain things schools can do. You just have to be willing to make those adjustments. So we were phenomenally successful. On any given day, we had 90% of our freshmen in our classes. The rest of the school were at 20, 30, and 40%. But my kids were totally isolated from the rest of the school. We were basically a school within a school. So when people tell me that even though we have high poverty areas in South Dakota, I don't think that's an excuse all the time to have low academic achievement. There are certain things schools can do to create success for the kids. That's just one small story.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Anybody? Well, with that, I want to thank you for coming. And, of course, we'll be in contact with you, and we're in hopes that if you have ideas for legislation that you will come forth with those and keep us posted that what we can do. Because that's our interest is, you know, the children are, mm-hmm. that's our future. And I think about my grandson here. He said, Grandpa, I'm going to be a pro football player. Or a doctor. I'll take care of you, he said. I want to take care of you. And so I just think that there's no end to what our kids can do down there.
Absolutely not.
I just think the sky's the limit. But somewhere along the line, we got to click a switch and turn that around to where it's a bigger percent of them have this goals. Future
sure.
on their mind and not, you know, whether mom's going to be able to feed them that night? Or
just like, and I would just like to end with, I'm very encouraged. I didn't know what to expect when I came to Pure, you know, but after sitting in on the management teams and listening to Secretary Oster and having him accompany me on a lot of school visits and sitting down and visiting with Indian educators, the one thing that stands out in my mind is that Secretary Oster is willing to, in his words, think out of the box. He's put that out there to the school saying, if you think you have some other type of program or if you need waivers or if you need different accreditation issues, whatever it takes to educate your children and help them be successful, he says, we're willing to do whatever it takes at the state level to help your school. And I've had a lot of Indian educators come up to me and saying, Luann, that is so encouraging to hear Secretary Oster say things like that. So we've had a few schools come up to us now with different plans that people would say, that's really innovative. You know, they're wanting to do immersion schools. They're wanting to try these other methods. And the state is definitely, we're just ready to work with everybody. Because, again, at the end of the day, they're all of their children of South Dakota, and we need to help them be successful. So thank you for listening to me, and
yeah. Well, thank you again. Representative Wink.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned Montana State University. You're doing some, going for your superintendent's degree there. And they have a different model than South Dakota does as far as their Indian education. Can you expand on that a little bit? And are their graduates, I assume their graduation rates are higher than in South Dakota, and that's the reason that you'd like to model this program after them? Yes. Did I understand that correctly?
I was specifically referring to their Department of Indian Education within their Department of Ed. They have a really wonderful resource set up for all the public teachers across the state. Basically, they have what's called a program, Education for All, whether you're native or non-native, and they have a very intense curriculum that their American Indian culture is infused into the state standards. That is something I'm looking at very closely at and would like to model South Dakota's at. Yes, they have a very good program. Mm-hmm.
That, by the way, the Secretary of Education in Montana is Juneau, isn't it?
And yes.
Yeah, she's a good friend of mine, and so is Senator Juneau, her mother. And we worked at the National Conference of Native American Legislators.
I see.
In fact, we're going to be meeting in D.C. next week, and I'm going to talk to Carol there. I'll be seeing her there. So, and they do. They really have moved a long ways Well, I credit her for a lot of that, really a lot of that. She's just outstanding on. And I think I wish you the best of everything in your job. I really do. And I think you're really started out on the right foot. And I don't think Mr. Moore has to worry. I think you'll take over in good shape. So.
Well, thank you for those kind words, Senator Bradford. Look forward to visiting with all of you again. Thank you.
Looks like our public testimony might be overloaded. At this time, we'll go into, if there is any, we'll take it now. And welcome.
Thank you, Senator Bradford. I'm Kathy Lucas. I'm a citizen lobbyist and a concerned citizen. And I have a tendency to go on and on and tell stories, so I made little talking points so that hopefully I won't take up too much of your beautiful day so you can go out and enjoy the day. First, I'd like to thank Luann Werdell. She made some really key points that could be applied toward education in general, and that is that children are not robots. They need individualized teaching in order to learn. Children come from different backgrounds. Throwing them all together in one pot doesn't work. You have your your disabled children, your developmentally disabled children. When you throw all these children into one pot, they all suffer. So what she's talking about is extremely important. I wish that the entire education committees, both House and Senate, were sitting here listening to her. I also want to thank Governor Rounds for all that he has done to promote cooperation between, I don't like to say Indians and whites so much, because race relations encompasses more than Indians and whites. It encompasses every racial background that people come from. So to work together to try to do the best for each child as far as education, I think, is just key. I want to thank the department heads. I've listened, Charlie McGuigan did a fantastic job this morning in educating me regarding the laws, tribal laws, state laws, federal laws. That was amazing. I wish more people could have heard him testify, as well as Lori Feiler, who is a dynamo. And I think we have these people to thank for furthering the relationship between all the people in South Dakota as far as working for what's best for our children, because they are our future. And I've said this before, but progress is being made. This is a wonderful committee. It's very informal. People don't have to feel too intimidated when they testify. And then there's still a ways to go, though. We know that. We have a long way to go. But the thing is, we're all working at it. We're all trying to understand each other and understand the backgrounds. Luann mentioned that a child who comes from a background where they don't get fed on a regular basis is going to learn differently from a child whose parents are highly involved in their education. So we have a long way to go with all of our problems. And so this is where I come to persevere. I hope people are listening on the internet, because I would like to encourage anybody who wants to seek help from the state to persevere. These people that work for the state, that are your elected officials, are public servants. Sometimes they forget that, but usually it's the people that surround them that forget it. I think even in a bank, if you go walk into a bank and say, I want to talk to John Doe, and he happens to be the president, the people that surround him have a tendency to think of John Doe as God. So they'll say, well, do you have an appointment? Because John Doe is a very busy man. So it's difficult to access sometimes, say, Mike Rounds, because he's a very busy man. But if you can access the right people in that department, and if they will actually help you to find the department that can help you with your problem, that's important. And as I mentioned this at the last meeting, I have sometimes had to talk to as many as 6 different people in state government to find the answer to my questions. But people, it's hard to negotiate the bureaucratic morass. It really is. It's difficult. And so the thing to do, you learn by doing, and just keep. So I want to tell people, I hope they're listening, to keep trying. And if you have a problem, contact your legislator, because they're vitally interested in their constituents and their constituent concerns. So contact your legislator. That legislator can negotiate the bureaucratic morass and find the answer to your question. So that's really important. And then I wanted to just say something else that I feel really strongly about education that concerns me a great deal, because when I went to school back in the dark ages, discipline was important. And I don't believe in hitting children, but I think that administrators and teachers are afraid of parents for whatever reason. They're afraid they're going to get sued. And I think that discipline is absolutely key to maintaining order in the classroom, to allow all children to at least have a chance at learning something in that class. When you have children who are disrupting the classroom, I believe they should be removed. They should be sent to the principal's office. This is just Kathy's theory of what should be done. And then the parents should be called and told that their child is disrupting the class. And then if the parents don't come and get them, then Child Protective Services should be called. I don't think children should be allowed to disrupt the classroom. But we're seeing a lot of that, and I think it's a fear of lawsuits, but that's just my opinion. And again, I want to thank all of you for taking the time to serve on this committee. I think it's a very important committee. I've watched it for 15 years, I guess. Progress is being made. Sometimes it seems, you can't see the progress that's being made, but the communication has improved so much. So I just want to thank all of you for serving on this committee, for helping. I sometimes say I live in a bubble. I don't know what's going on out there. But you, Senator Bradford, have really helped, as well as other legislators have helped those of us who kind of are insulated or isolated from knowing what's going on out there, and you have helped us to learn what's going on out there. And I just want to thank you for that. And I want to thank Tom and Rita for working so hard on this committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. I admire you for your perseverance, because you don't you represent the real people, and it's that's true. You know, the common everyday person is most of the time too scared to sit in those chairs, and then to testify is hard. I know, because when I have legislation, that I go back to my people and say, come testify. We want this to happen. And they just are very fearful, and so I appreciate your candor. With that, I guess we're pretty well done. Do you want to take a break, or do you want to just get on with so we can get gone? All I wanted to really talk about was our next meeting. And what we had decided pretty much was that we would meet on a reservation. So I would like to see that happen. And we had said, and we've always said, that we will go to a reservation on an invitation basis. We do not want to Do we have somebody coming? No. Anyway, so I'm going to ask Tom if we've had any invitations.
Okay. Well, after session, we sent out a letter to each tribe asking if they would be interested in having the committee meet there. I got two responses, one from Rosebud, where we met last year, and one from Sisseton, Wahpeton, where we met in 2007, I think. Did not hear from the others, although that doesn't mean that we couldn't, you know, inquire and meet somewhere else. But the two that responded were those two.
Well, I know Representative Junkie was, when he was chairman with Senator Tubos, we all pretty much decided that we wouldn't go to a we would feel we were an intrusive to go on a reservation that didn't invite us. So I think I want to kind of stick by that. And if we have to go back to one of these two, it'd be fine. But what I thought was that maybe since we're not going to do any official business, we could more or less, first of all, we should decide when we want to meet again. We get one more meeting before the...
We could do two more meetings.
Two more meetings. So we could decide what time... You know, we have a tough time getting the people to meetings for some reason, but... But anyway, Representative Ring, do you have any ideas?
Well, I wonder if the meetings should be driven by issues rather than just time slots. I mean, if there are some issues that need to be discussed, that there need to be brought out, then by all means, let's meet and get them out there. But to meet just for the sake of meeting, to have two meetings instead of one, I wouldn't be in favor of that.
All right. I can see that, too. I do think that probably in the case of meeting on a reservation is that, as you see, we get very few of those people to come to actually testify to their issues here. And when if we go, every time we've gone to reservations, in fact, to Rosebud, I don't care which, we've been to almost all of them now. And every time we've had plenty of issues come up there once we get out there to where those people are. So what it does, it just awakens a committee to things that are happening there that never reach here, and how we could help with some of those. And I do know that we've met in Rosebud twice, but both meetings were very, very well attended. They were well ran. One, we even met side by side with the consul. They met a while, we met a while. We talked and we listened to them. And to me, that was probably one of the greatest awakenings. I know it was for those on our committee who had never been inside of a tribal building, let alone listened to their issues. So I think that's part of our goal here is for those that, you know, I don't have a problem. I'm every day, I deal with it, every single day. But it's kind of like when I get on a committee to go to areas where I don't understand their problems, but I think it's good for the committee. I just think it's very worthwhile, and we had decided we'd definitely meet on the reservation. So I'm gonna stipulate that. It's the biggest thing is whether we want to and see that last. If we have two more meetings, but that last meeting I would like to have after, at least after the election, after everything's done, so you know where you're. If there is some issues you want to talk about right here in Pierre, where you want to talk about legislation, then. So, but what I was trying to say was, how about we leave it with Tom and myself, and we'll work on it, and then we'll let every one of you know where, what, and which, and try to work it, and give him a lot of leeway, you know, say, fall, is say we'll meet again in the fall. So in that way Tom can try to talk, and maybe and I'll be talking to Rodney in Rosebud, because I know he would like to see us come down, maybe we can, Rodney has some specific things in maybe the health area or other areas that we could be of a benefit or service. So with that, all I'd ask is that we have permission, Tom and I, to try to set up a meeting that will work for everybody, but that it will be on by invitation. If there is, and if some of you have an idea, say that Standing Rock or Maher, maybe at Eagle Butte even, I'm perfectly willing to go to either one of them. We've been there, and it was great up there too. I know that like I said, I visited last night with a guy from the Rosebud, because I stay pretty close with Paul, and this guy's
They're working on two wind energy projects down there, two of them, and it's a major thing, especially because when they're done with these wind energies, they got to have state cooperation for that grid in order to get rid of that energy. And it's so those kind of issues are I know would be coming up. Also, there's quite a bit of work going on right now with the law enforcement. They're trying to upgrade that. And I don't know if you guys noticed, but Charlie said, what did he say? They had 20-some graduate out here. Well, I've always tried to get them to get the Fed qualifications. They don't have the Fed qualifications yet. We've got, 100 and some officers down at Pine Ridge. We've got over 100 officers. And before they're done, fully qualified, they'll end up in Artesia. And there's no reason for that. I mean, here we are with one of the finest academies there is. But somewhere along the line, we don't have the federal part of that qualification for a BIA officer. So I just think that those are the kinds of issues and things we need to talk about. Senator Oliver.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the issues that we've talked about quite a bit and was addressed on the Rosebud Reservation was IHS services and Indian health care. If we couldn't get an invitation from either Pine Ridge or Standing Rock or one of the Western reservations, perhaps we could work out an arrangement with Rapid City Regional Hospital to get a reporter update from them and what they see are challenges and needs that would help us address, in a roundabout way, help us address maybe some of the services that could be provided on the reservation and give us a little direction as far as what we could do as a legislature to help improve those services.
That's a good idea. It fascinates me. Some things are going on that we don't. It's a whole different life from one reservation to the other. I talked last night to a lady, young gal, and she said, "I've been down Rosebud to the hospital. I just got out." I said, "What? Oh, they put tubes in my ears." And I said, "In Rosebud? You know, when I went to Rosebud, when the horse kicked me in the head, they didn't even give Novocaine, let alone put tubes in your ears." But she said, "Now they have a specialist doctor. He comes in, and they put these tubes in the ear, and the doctor comes there, and now she said, "Pretty soon there will be one that comes in, a specialist in the eyes. And during that period of time, people with major eye problems will get to." Well, that's fantastic. I mean, that's what it should have been done for a long time ago. But what happens is that, as you said, you got a facility that's millions and millions of dollars to build, and everything's there, but a doctor to do it. That's what we're talking about. So you load them up in an airplane. Like, I also experienced that helicopter flight from Pine Ridge to Rapid City, and that's a little $8,000-$10,000 trip just from.
And, you got kicked on the wrong day.
And that, yeah. but anyway, if it's all right with you, fellas.
Folks on the committee, we'll try to work it so maybe the time when we could all be could all attend. I would really like to see, especially those members that, like I said, you know, that don't experience the actual reservation experience that much. Do some of the issues. I also know that Rosebud.
A podcast of SDPB's online coverage is available at sdpb.org.